This is a day typically meant for rest and relaxation. Local parades, family barbecues. But no one will be marching down Main Street today, and there appears to be a consensus that it's for the best. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer Kent. Memorial Day celebrations have been moved online this year, and this afternoon at 3, people across the state are being asked to acknowledge a moment of silence, and followed by Taps. You're being asked to play Taps, an incredibly difficult, almost impossible song to play. You can download the song and attend virtually online today at WisVetsMemorialDay2020.com. All the links from the show can always be found at WPR.org/mornings, so you'll find them there along with the links for the rest of our guests. But I'm curious how you'll be spending this holiday. 1-800-642-1234. It's different this year, no doubt. But how did this holiday get started? And how did it remain such an important part of our culture? James Martin is an author, professor, and the chair of the history department at Marquette University. James, good morning. Thank you for being here. And I'd like to begin with a legend of Major General John Logan. Who was the Major General John Logan?
Good morning. John Logan was a politician in Illinois before the Civil War. And as such, he got the attention of the governor of Illinois when the Civil War broke out, raised a regiment of Union soldiers, and became one of the more effective so-called political generals of the war and rose to a pretty high rank. And after the war, he became one of the leaders of the first and primary veterans organization for Union soldiers who survived the war, the Grand Army of the Republic, the GAR. And so Logan, as the first commander, declared on May 30th, 1868, that that would be Memorial Day, or what was called the time Decoration Day. And the main thing was to actually decorate the graves of Union soldiers who had died during the war. Speeches were given, prayers were made. There'd be this pretty familiar kind of ceremony to what we would attach to Memorial Day. But Logan is credited with being the person who declared the first sort of official Memorial Day recognized by Union veterans.
So if you were to take us back to 1868, the sights, the smells, the sounds, what's going on in the context of the first Decoration Day?
Well, I think these Decoration Day ceremonies would have built on traditional commemoration of dead Americans. Even during the war, women would gather to decorate the graves of recently deceased soldiers. This is also a time when it's very important to identify and to rebury Union soldiers who died in battle. Many of them were buried right on the battlefield, and there's a major effort after the war to bring them into national cemeteries. Gettysburg is, I think, the first and most famous of the big national cemeteries. Arlington becomes a cemetery during the war and just after, outside of Washington. And increasingly, there are major national cemeteries near all of the big battlefields for the Civil War. And so from the very small local ceremonies that would have been in a churchyard or a town cemetery, to the bigger ceremonies at the big city national cemeteries, there'd be speeches, there'd be prayers, there'd be parade of veterans. The GAR especially would come out that day in their uniforms. And it would be, again, a very familiar sight to anyone who's been to a formal Memorial Day ceremony.
So what we saw on the first Decorations Day is we can, or at least most recently, still saw on Memorial Day here in the Wisconsin. So this group of the Grand Army of the Republic, who were among their ranks and what became of them?
Anybody could join who'd been a veteran. And so I think the closest thing to it in our modern life is the American Legion. It's a very broadly defined group. As long as you had served with honor, you didn't have to have been in combat. I think you had to have maybe 6 months of service, and you could join. And they were locally organized. These days we think of the VFW American Legion having, fish fries at their posts and so forth. GAR had local posts. They all had names. There were six or seven here in Milwaukee, for instance. There were, probably 100-150 GAR posts around Wisconsin. And they would meet once a week, once a month, depending on the time of year. They tell stories about their wartime experiences, both sort of about combat and about funny, you know, camp life. They did a lot of charity work for fellow veterans. They buy groceries. They try to find jobs for them. It's a social outreach kind of organization as well. But mainly it was to keep alive the memory of the war for themselves. It's a way for them to talk about their own contributions to saving the Union and for some, you know, ending slavery. But also to keep that contribution alive, the memory of their fellow Americans. And so they were very much about recognizing the importance of their roles in the Union effort.
Marquette University History Professor James Martin is with us on this Memorial Day as we explore the history of this day and its observances. And I do appreciate the history of the Arlington Cemetery. Would you please detail that for us, James? What was it originally?
Well, it was when the war began, it was Robert E. Lee's home. through his wife, I believe. They lived in Northern Virginia. And about the time the war is beginning, I believe Lee's family was there. Lee was, of course, in the U.S. Army. He was away, had come back, resigned from the Army, had received an offer to be a general in the Virginia forces being raised. And almost as soon as the war began in earnest in April of 1861, probably early May, Union forces crossed the river, the Potomac River, and occupied Arlington. And it became a base of operations for Union forces. It became one of the biggest and best equipped contraband camps, as they were called, homes of escaped slaves.
Was that because it was strategically placed, James, or was that because it was Robert E. Lee's front yard?
Well, I think it was strategically placed is why it became a base. It's Northern Virginia. It's the south side of Potomac. It's a good launching point, you know, for movements into Virginia. I think it's a handy place for the slaves to congregate because it's within Union lines, and they're safe there. It becomes a cemetery during the war as well, and it's often said that's kind of because it was Robert Lee's home. It was a way of punishing Lee and his family. And so it grew into, you know, the biggest of the major national cemeteries afterwards.
So on that Decoration Day at Arlington Cemetery, what's happening? 1868?
And it's across the country, so it's not just at Arlington even. But okay. at Arlington, you'd have, I'm sure Logan was there. There'd be a parade of veterans into the cemetery. All of the veterans' graves would have a wreath of some kind or a GAR badge. You know, even this is a little aside, even around small town cemeteries in Wisconsin today, you'll see a little GAR marker for the graves of guys that they have certified to be
Sure.
war veterans. And so, again, it's very dignified. It's very plain. It's not fancy. And the speeches would be about sacrifice, about patriotism, linking the soldiers from their deaths to the future greatness of America. It's not quite a script, but it's a very typical thing that first Memorial Day and afterwards.
We're taking you back in time this morning with our guest, author, professor, and chair of the History Department at Marquette University, James Martin, Major General John Logan, and the first Decoration Day in 1868 across this country, as it still can be seen in ways today, albeit on this day, virtually and online or out your front door at 3 p.m. with a moment of silence followed by taps. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. Was speaking at Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day in 1871, Frederick Douglass made the clear case against false equivalencies in our Civil War, saying, quoting here, "We must never forget that victory to the rebellion meant death to the Republic. We must never forget that the loyal soldiers who rest beneath this sod flung themselves between the nation and the nation's destroyers. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this day is about more than the Civil War now, but Douglass's salute for the sacrifices made for the sake of the Union still reverberate through time and into today. This day is about the sacrifice of those who fought for something greater than themselves, and you can feel free to share those stories on this day at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@wpr.org. James Martin joins us, chair of the history department at Marquette University, author of Sing Not War, The Lives of Union and Confederate Veterans in Gilded Age America. What about before the first Decoration Day? What about before 1868? You could say that honoring the fallen soldiers goes back to Rome, Greece, and even prior to that. But what about in the United States? Were we seeing what would become Decoration Day prior to 1868, James?
Oh, certainly. I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, small towns and women's organizations would have honored recently deceased Union veterans and Confederate veterans, too. This is a North and South thing. And so there's a number of communities had formal occasions during the war, usually late spring, early summer, more or less around, you know, May 30th, which becomes the traditional Memorial Day or Decoration Day, rather. And it's, you know, part of this is through women's organizations created to raise money and to support troops during the war. After the war, it became they kind of evolved into the Women's Relief Corps, which was the women's auxiliary, as they used to call them, to the GAR. And so it's a very natural thing for the women to decorate the graves, to honor the war dead. It's customary, you know, as you mentioned, through history to do this. And so there were many Memorial Days or Decoration Days going on before 1868. One of the more, it wasn't famous at the time, although you can see small articles about it in newspapers, but a few years ago it was rediscovered. The kind of first post-war Memorial Day actually took place in Charleston, South Carolina, when hundreds of newly freed African-Americans held a ceremony in honor of dead Union soldiers who had died at a prison camp in Charleston at an old race course, were buried there. And that kind of becomes, in some ways, the first. I don't think Logan didn't know about it. The GAR wasn't modeling their ceremonies on this, but really one of the first post-war ceremonies was early May 1865 when, again, free African-Americans in Charleston honored the Union dead.
May help explain why, according to the VA anyway, about 25 places across the country claim connection to the origins of Memorial Day. So would you designate a birthplace for Memorial Day, or is it just it happened across the country in one way or another until it caught on for all of us?
I think it's a normal impulse in times of war and just after to honor the dead in that way. Sort of a spirit of commemoration, I think, that took place. So I don't think there's any one place that originated it. Memorial Day.
You've studied the Civil War, and the Civil War, unlike our other wars in this country, it was here at home. What was it like to be a Civil War veteran? What was it like to be a veteran of the Union or Confederate Army after the war was over? What were their lives like?
Like veterans of any war, a higher percentage of them had seen combat than in modern wars. Many of them would have been had lasting disabilities. The famous ones are men who lost arms and legs, and there were 60,000 amputations of limbs during the war. Over 600,000 died. Probably another million or so had been wounded. Many of them were just sick and worn out. Very common things that we'd be able to shake off quickly were harder to shake off back then. But rheumatism and dysentery and arthritis and various other ailments really slowed down many veterans. And so they became part of the first major social welfare system in the country, the pension system. And so the first pensions given in the United States were to volunteer soldiers from the Civil War. It becomes the biggest part of the federal budget by the late 19th century. So to be a veteran was to be honored on Decoration Day, and the 4th of July was a big day. Not all veterans belonged to a veterans organization, but many did. They had annual encampments. Milwaukee had a big one in 1880, for instance, which kind of sparked a renewal of the GAR and, you know, tens of thousands of veterans would show up. So it's very much like any other big convention in that sense. And they were very, as I said earlier, interested in promoting the memory of the war, their memory of the war, and their contribution to the safety of the United States.
So what do you think when we get to today and we take a look back and get some perspective on this Memorial Day that has now encompassed our veterans, those who are serving, and those who have fallen and beyond the Civil War from all of our military combat? As a historian, what's your outlook on this holiday?
Well, I think one of the commonalities between today and the past is the extraordinary emotional attachment that Americans tend to have for veterans of sacrifice. We've had long years of warfare in our own lives here, and a lot of attention paid to veterans coming home, and especially in the reserves and National Guard. They're really coming out of communities in the same way that war veterans came out of their communities. And so on this day and some others, support our troops, support our veterans is a very emotional appeal. At the same time, there's a disjunction between that and how veterans are treated sometimes. And not so much purposefully here in the United States, but difficulties with the opioid crisis, for instance.
Institutionally,
especially.
Interpersonally, I haven't seen those experiences, but institutionally, veterans face challenges today. And on this day, if there were any day, those would be challenges that maybe should be addressed.
There are ironies, you know, and Civil War veterans had the same thing. They had the same psychological issues, although they didn't know what to call it then, physical issues, and faced challenges in getting their pension claims approved, you know, and there was a lot of suspicion of Civil War soldiers who were receiving pensions among some parts of the population.
Explain that a little further, James Martin.
You had to prove that your disability was related to your war experience. And since most of the disabled weren't really obvious, I lost an arm or a leg or my sight, it was, I'm sick, I can't work very hard, I can't, you know, I'm suffering in that way. There was a very elaborate process you had to go through to prove that you were really disabled, that your disability wasn't caused by your drunkenness or your laziness or whatever. And it becomes very political because it is very expensive. This is a time when no one else is receiving a pension from an employer or from a government. It's a really special program at the time. It becomes the basis of Social Security in terms of how it's run in a way in the 1930s. And so it's not surprisingly becomes kind of a political football. At the time, the Republican Party is the one pushing for pensions and for government care. The Democratic Party tends to be, as I said before, just suspicious of the whole pension program. And it becomes, by the 1880s and 90s, a very controversial thing.
A few minutes we have left here in learning about you, James, I have found out that among everything else, you're also the co-editor of a 6-volume anthology of the history of children and family. Mm-hmm. Families right now are facing challenges they've never faced in their lifetimes. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if you could provide some perspective on what families are going through today and what history suggests they might expect in the days to come, months or years.
Well, let's see. I think from a historical standpoint, this is pretty unique in that we have so many institutions that shape the lives of children and families today that even 30, 40, 50 years ago did not, probably not 100 or 200 years ago. And so I think one of the differences about this particular moment in time is we've kind of lost those institutions up to a point. My kids are grown. They're not here now, but the schools are playing less of a role in their everyday lives. We're not going to the doctor as much. There's many institutions aren't in our daily lives anymore, and even for adults for that matter. And so it's a little bit uncharted in that sense. How do we get back to that? How do we recapture those institutional relationships between children and families and the government or local communities or nonprofits? There's lots of things that have to be rebuilt 200 years ago, you were kind of on your own anyway, in a sense. And we're used to not being on our own now, and this has, in a certain way, I don't want to exaggerate it. There's still been plenty of support, obviously, but there is it's a different kind of relationship that one has to an institution if you don't interact with it, you know, personally, any given time.
I very much appreciate the perspective, James Martin. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
James Martin chairs the History Department at Marquette University, specializing in the Civil War history, and the co-editor of a compendium on children and family history. Up next is news. Then we take a look at how the Department of Veterans Affairs has been managing the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. U.S. Army veteran Joe Williams was discharged from the Milwaukee Veterans Affairs Medical Center on Friday. And according to WTMJ, Williams spent 2 months in the hospital battling COVID-19. He received a hero send-off just ahead of Memorial Day with medical staff and family. You know, the other heroes in this equation celebrating as well and cheering as Joe Williams started his trip home. At last check, the Veterans Administration has reported more than 1,000 coronavirus deaths, but our next guest says the true toll is much greater and growing. More than 2,000 VA staffers have been infected, with at least 30 staffer deaths there. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Kate Archer Kent. I'd like to invite you to join us in sharing your experiences with our Veterans Administration at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Alex Horton served in Iraq as a U.S. Army infantryman, and he writes about the military and national security for The Washington Post. Alex, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about those numbers. As you've reported on the rates of veterans who've been infected with COVID-19, what do you know about the real numbers?
So it's really an iceberg statistic at this point. We know as of this morning that VA is reporting about 1,130 deaths across its hospital network, and that's about 170 hospitals across the country. What we do know is that also includes about 400 folks who are not at VA hospitals but died elsewhere and was reported to VA. But there is a larger number underneath that where VA is not, for reasons I don't understand yet, adding numbers from people who died in state-run veterans' homes, the most notorious of which would be the Holyoke one in Massachusetts, where more than 70 veterans have died. There have been some estimates that as many as 550 or more veterans would be added to that toll. So that would put the real number closer to 2,000, even though it's officially right now about 1,130.
Has the VA given any reason why the state hospitals are not included in their numbers?
They haven't. I've asked about that. So it's not very clear yet. It's also not clear how many of those that they receive data from and they're posting as part of their roll-up may include those. You know, we don't know what their reporting line through is. You know, they could be people who die at private hospitals. They could be people that die at home. We just don't know the makeup of these people. So it's the veterans
and it's the coronavirus that would count among those ranks, I would imagine. But how many states are not reporting veterans' deaths at this point, Alex?
More than half. 28 states aren't reporting them officially. It varies state by state. You know, these are homes that receive some VA funding, and VA has oversight in terms of inspecting them, but their management is really run up to the states. And some states are more transparent than others. So New Jersey, for example, who has a state that has had a lot of deaths itself, close to the epicenter of the coronavirus in general, they report in their veterans' homes the numbers of each death at each home. And that is something other states just don't do. So the simple answer and the frustrating answer is you know, it depends on which state you died if that number is going to surface.
Alex Horton is our guest. He's an Iraq veteran himself, and he writes about the military and national security for The Washington Post. I did not know that not everyone at a VA facility is, however, a veteran. There is a fourth mission for our Veterans Administration, and what role does that play as we look at their service?
So the fourth mission was created, in recent decades as sort of a realization that, you know, VA is a network of integrated hospitals. In fact, it's the largest integrated hospital network in the country, and it's possible that it might even be the biggest in the world. So there's 170 big hospitals. There's a lot more smaller community-based facilities. So at one point, when you look at FEMA and HHS and VA, VA has an ability to flex their resources in times of national emergency to help people who didn't serve in the military. And this has happened in regional crises around the country. For example, during Hurricane Katrina in 2005, folks who needed medical care or needed a place to stay, they went to other places of VA hospitals, some in Tennessee, some in other places, and were served there. The Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, after that happened, and there was an enormous amount of people who needed mental health counseling, VA counselors who are very, experienced in post-traumatic stress were on hand to offer counseling to folks who were in that shooting. So there is a history of non-veterans using VA care. It's usually temporary. It's usually an extraordinary event. We do know that, somewhere upwards of 100-something people have gone to VA hospitals to be seen and treated for coronavirus. Again, this is not something VA both touts the mission, but they don't really tout the specifics. The last number I saw in March was, I think, somewhere over 100. When I've asked about updated statistics, that's not something they've provided to us.
Alex Horton often covers the military and national security for The Washington Post, and on this Memorial Day, we're taking a look at how the Department of Veterans Affairs has managed amid the coronavirus pandemic. And the statistics don't begin to tell the stories, and the statistics might not be all of the count at this point. And Alex, Wisconsin's no different than most states operating veterans' homes. How would you describe the effect that the coronavirus has had on these facilities?
Well, it comes down to policy, and it comes down to preparedness. In Massachusetts and New Jersey, it swept through brutally in these homes. And when it comes to, reaction, and when it comes to how prepared they were, it seems to have varied. When you look at veterans' homes in the Pacific Northwest, where, the original outbreak, if you remember, it seems like an eternity ago, but, the Seattle area and others, they didn't really have to deal with these issues. And, they were the most caught off guard. So it comes down to that, I think. The other side, too, is, the hospitals vary very much, but they also seem to track with coronavirus outbreaks generally. The four biggest hospitals dealing with the most death and the most infections at VA are no surprise. They're in New Jersey, New York, and New Orleans. And right now they're dealing with the hardest hit patients, but that is sort of symmetrical with their communities. Some facilities are doing better. Some report very few outbreaks and deaths. Long before coronavirus, veterans criticized VA as an agency by saying, when you've been to one VA, you've been to one VA, which just means some have a good reputation, some don't. VA in recent years has released a ranking of their patient satisfaction. And, then you can go on and look and, I'm not saying this one's good or bad, but you go to the Oakland VA Medical Center in California and they're rock bottom, I think you might be upset that, you're not getting good care as you were in San Francisco, for instance.
What about those care workers, Alex? Our veterans are one half of the equation, but inside those VA facilities are the employees, and some of them have been demonstrating to try to raise awareness about the conditions that they're facing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, VA was no different than a lot of hospitals that face PPE shortages. The only difference is, you know, VA is a public institution, and they do have an obligation to talk about their resources and to talk about their challenges. We were hearing since March that VA was prepared for this with masks and gowns and other equipment. Internally, however, they were worried that they were going to run out, that they were competing with everyone else in the country and the world for that equipment. So they were really saying one thing and doing another. Behind the scenes, they were talking about, you know, days and weeks worth of equipment before they ran out. So, yes, that has led to protests at local facilities. It led to, various unions of the employees to talk about it in terms of life and death. You know, I've heard from multiple folks across the country who work at VA regarding a few policies. One specifically is telework, when they say, you know, I'm a social worker or I'm a scheduler and there's no reason for me to come into work. I could do it remotely, and I know other people who have the same job. They do it remotely too. And here I am exposing myself and maybe putting veterans at risk, maybe putting, my coworkers at risk. And that is something that has been a brewing frustration among VA workers.
We started our conversation, Alex, talking about what the real casualty rate may be among our veterans when it comes to the coronavirus and some of those numbers not adding up and you wondering why that would be. Talking about the VA denying shortages of personal protective equipment while at the same time you were reporting that there are clear shortages that could be found from the rank and file on the ground. When you you're a journalist, so you don't speculate, but what role does public relations play in what we know about what's going on in our VA?
Yeah. What's interesting is, you know, after I got out of the Army, I actually had a job in VA public affairs in the central office in Washington, helped building the digital office. And our mission was not to talk to the media. It was to talk to veterans themselves. So even though we saw ourselves as inherently different in the scope of what we were doing, I got to see the press secretary and other public affairs officials work and what they decided to talk about and what they decided to deflect on. So it's kind of given me an interesting perspective for a reporter.
It's a perspective we're grateful for, but we've got to hold right there. Alex Horton rejoins us in just 2 minutes. Hang tight. And if you've got a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, talking about our Veterans Administration, our military, those who serve on this Memorial Day, and there's still time for you. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. It's Memorial Day on The Morning Show, and you're listening to The Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and full disclosure here, I am the son of a Vietnam veteran. And good morning, Dad. Please don't text me during the show. He was drafted, and if you ask him what we could do to honor the fallen, he would tell you to do whatever you can for those who have served or are serving now. Do whatever it takes to help keep them from ever becoming another one of the fallen. My dad reports that the VA has always treated him respectfully and right. What do you have to report? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest has been reporting on the Veterans Administration and military for the Washington Post. Alex Horton is also a veteran. And as we left the conversation, you were talking about your role in the PR department of the Veterans Administration. How has that work defined your role now as a journalist covering the VA?
I think this kind of gives me a little depth of understanding of not just how public affairs works, but how the building itself works. It's the second biggest federal agency in the government. You know, there's a lot of employees that work there. It has its own culture. So it's kind of given me that perspective. But also, it gives me an understanding of the tools available to veterans that I myself helped build, that, you know, it doesn't appear to me that they're being utilized the way I would or the way they were designed to. For example, I was brought on to develop the agency's blog, Vantage Point, and I was going to punch it up and see what they're talking about on it. You know, when we designed it and thought of it, you know, we thought of a way to connect directly to veterans who always felt VA was talking at them and not with them, not listening to them and not having an outlet to communicate. So, you know, in recent years after I left in 2013, it has become more of a landing page for press releases. We wanted to distinguish ourselves greatly by that. And now I see news releases as a top function of the blog. There's right now I'm looking at the website at blog.va.gov. If any of your listeners wanted to look at it, their top story is the counter for coronavirus across the country. You know, they have podcasts and things like that. But there's not a whole lot of straight talk on what VA is doing besides, you know, sort of reposting their press releases. Sometimes, you know, when there's a critical story in the press, they will post a defense of that, defense of the agency naming the article. So, you know, for instance, I think what I would do in this scenario is I would be creating posts that target specific veterans who are at risk. You know, veterans as a demographic are older than most Americans. You know, the average age is, you know, in the 50s. So, you know, a veteran just plucked from the population at random will be more at risk of contracting and having complications from coronavirus than anyone else. So,
but our veterans are also an inordinate number of our homeless population. They also have mental health issues that need to be dealt with because they've seen things that most of us could never imagine. So they're already a vulnerable population as it is. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and there is a question about what more can be done.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've asked VA this. I said, you know, we know African-Americans and Hispanics and other minorities, they're more at risk at contracting coronavirus and having complications. What are you doing to reach them? They didn't have an answer for me. And then after that, they said they were preparing ways to target those folks. Other reporters have asked, what are you doing to reach Agent Orange affected veterans? Because that's something that affects the lungs very greatly and the heart. They didn't have an answer for them either. And then later they said, okay, we're going to start seeing if we can identify ways to contact veterans who have been exposed to Agent Orange. Same thing goes for burn pits. Even though VA says, okay, you know, we'll see what we can do. All they did was say, hey, if you think this can impact your health, join the burn pit registry, which doesn't really do anything for you health-wise. It just lets VA know that, you know, you may have been exposed to toxic things in your service. So, you know, when I see the tools available to VA and the breadth of their reach on social media, on Facebook and Twitter and on their blog, you know, I really don't see an aggressive full court press to reach veterans the way they could.
Washington Post reporter Alex Horton is with us as we discuss how the coronavirus pandemic has affected those serving in the U.S. military, as well as our veterans on this Memorial Day. And Alex, you've got a story in the Washington Post from over the weekend about how veterans are dealing with this Memorial Day, how families of our armed service members are dealing with this Memorial Day. And it's unlike any other in our lifetimes. What did you find?
Well, I found, you know, people who have new traditions, they have old traditions that are disrupted. I talked to one Afghanistan veteran who, you know, for the past several years, you know, makes a short drive to Arlington National Cemetery and walks Section 60, which is where, you know, the newest fallen are buried. You know, when you walk on it, it's the ground is so fresh that it feels lumpy because it hasn't had time to settle yet. And he can't do that this year because it's only closed to it's only open to families and closed to everyone else. You know, so you can't see those friends that, you know, died 13 years ago. It also disrupts travel if you wanted to come in from a long ways away. I talked to Joe Kent, whose wife was a Navy cryptologist, Shannon Kent. She was killed in a suicide bombing in Syria last year. And he had planned to see a new exhibit with Shannon at the Women's Memorial at Arlington. It's sort of a museum. And there was going to be a display with her that he wanted to see in March. He wasn't able to go to that because of growing virus concerns. And then he was also planning to just to visit Shannon in a very quiet moment today, you know, flying in from Portland, Oregon. But, you know, he couldn't do that because he has parents, he has children. So what he's going to do this year, you know, just a couple of weeks after Mother's Day, is he's going to unfurl her uniforms while his two sons gather around him, and he's going to tell them what his what their mother once did.
Our service members aren't the only ones that serve. Their families do as well. And our service members aren't the only ones who are casualties. Their families can have to deal with the fallout as well. Finally, this morning, Alex, a lot of talk has come up about the drug hydroxychloroquine. The president has said that he has been using it. He has certainly promoted it. Is it being used in the VA? Do we know? And if so, how?
Yes, it's being used in, you know, the first big study that came out that showed that there could be issues with it came from VA itself. It came from the Columbia VA Medical Center in South Carolina with other folks looking at it. And it was a retrospective study, so they looked at data going back. It wasn't a study they were conducting themselves. So and it wasn't peer-reviewed, so take that for what you will. But what they did find is that there was no apparent benefit from patients who took hydroxychloroquine within VA, and if you did, there was a greater chance of death. So for folks who took the drug, almost a third of them died, but only 11.4% of them who didn't do anything, hydroxychloroquine and the combination drug, died. So it was associated with a greater rate of death within VA. There was a And after that study came out, VA said, okay, you know, it's promising for younger veterans as a treatment. They didn't specify when I asked VA about this. And, you know, VA Secretary Robert Wilkie said that on MSNBC, you know, there's promising signs. You know, this study is, you know, it's not peer-reviewed. You know, don't worry about it. They talked about the younger benefit, the younger veteran benefit. When I asked VA about that, they said, okay, well, that's anecdotal. And then there was a new study published in the last couple of days in Lancet that also the same circumstances, you know, was observational, retrospective, same issues that, you know, there could be problems, especially with people with heart issues.
Seems to be building to some degree medical consensus here on hydroxychloroquine, at least with the limited trials that we are aware of, correct?
Right. And I asked VA about this after the study published on Friday. I asked them, you know, they already said that they're still continuing to issue this for coronavirus treatment. And I asked them, okay, now that you have the second study, what are your plans now? Does this give you pause? Are you reevaluating your policy? I haven't heard back. I checked in yesterday and the only response was, you know, what is your deadline and what story are you working on?
Alex, what is your deadline? When can we look at find the story?
Yeah.
I appreciate you joining us this morning. Alex Horton is a journalist with the Washington Post. Look for his byline there, reporting on the military, our veterans, and national security. Up next, On Point, making peace with modern morality, with the creator of The Office, Parks and Recreation, The Good Place, Michael Schur laughs about how to be good. On Point is next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.